So I'm sitting here with Dr. Christian Smith, who is a professor at Notre Dame and has been doing research on the spirituality of youth and young adults as part of the National Study of Youth and Religion. In Souls in Transition, you said that a way a culture treats its youth says a lot about the culture.
Yes. I learned this partly from my wife's observation and having children of our own, that it struck us, having children, that there's an awful lot of sort of double standards and bad conscience and sort of weird things that go on around adults and how they think about and treat youth. They say, oh, we love children, we're a family-loving society and this and that, where really a lot of things aren't loving of children and don't prioritize children and their needs, don't really support the family. And so that just intrigued me sociologically. Increasingly I thought, well, a study about teenagers isn't just a study about teenagers. By studying teenagers and looking through the window, so to speak, of young people, that provides a whole different view of sort of the whole society and culture and what our priorities and commitments and institutions are all about.
What conclusions have you come to about American culture then?
Our culture is being corrupted by mass consumer capitalism, sort of immediate entertainment, and radical individualism that focuses all authority and choices in the individual self. That's a pretty negative view of things. It's more complicated than that, but I think we have some real cultural challenges around an outlook on life that's really centered on material well-being, financial security, upper middle class success is the ultimate goal, and really compromises community, relationships, commitment, neighborhoods, church, and so on in the process.
And isn't that just what emerging adults, like, statistically are looking for? Community and belonging and meaning, is that true?
Well, they do. They are looking for that. But they're even more, they're at the same time and perhaps even more looking for fun, interesting experiences, different relationships, variety, not sinking down roots. And so you can't have everything. You can't have community and commitment and etc. And have, I'll keep all my options open and I'll just have a lot of fun. So most emerging adults end up resolving that tension by saying, I'll have sort of community by hanging out with friends for a while. I'll live the emerging adult lifestyle for a while, and then I'll shift over into a really settled down, have a family, be part of a community in a neighborhood, have a career. That gets postponed. Or people look for during the emerging adult years, people end up looking for community and intimacy in, you know, what you might consider inappropriate ways, like the hookup culture or cohabitation or whatever, that is sort of like pseudo-community, pseudo-intimacy. But then a lot of people really find out it's just not the same thing as a commitment for life, you know.
Maybe that's where the church can be poised ready to point them in.
Well, the church teaches this. Many churches do, though not all do, but a lot of emerging adults just don't want to listen. They don't want to hear it, you know. They don't want to feel bad about themselves. They don't want to think they're doing something wrong. And so they just sort of push that away for a while. They don't listen to that for a while.
Now, your job as a sociologist has been to record, to survey and to record how young emerging adults feel, what they think. This is how it is. Mm-hmm. Like, that's your job.
Yeah.
But beyond that, do you have any, like, do you have any ideas of, like, things that the church could do to reach young adults, that Christians could do to reach emerging adults? Or has it all been, this is just how it is and this is where my job stops?
Yeah. As a sociologist, like, my main task and my main contribution is to describe and analyze the world as it is. Just to portray an accurate picture, as accurate as possible, of what's going on, what's happening, and why as possible. My hope is that people in different communities, including churches, will take that information and sort out, what does this mean, what are the implications, what does this imply? I do go around and speak to groups, and I try to answer questions as much as possible. There clearly are implications from our research, but I'm also not a church consultant. I'm not a ministry person. I'm really not qualified. You know, I can give ideas, I can give some advice, but really I think in the end, the findings of our research, people who read the book, different communities really need to sort out for themselves what they're going to do about it, if anything.
That's a fair answer. No, I think, I mean, those ministry experts need what you've done so that they can build off of it and they can do something.
I mean, it's just not the job of sociologists to go around the world and tell everyone what they should be doing.
Do a lot of people ask you, though?
People would like magic bullets. They want the silver bullet that'll solve the problem. And the world is much more complicated than that. So part of my job is just educating people in the complexities and the causes of things that just instituting a new program isn't going to solve a problem or whatever. They really need to get a view of the forest and not just the trees. They need to understand the causal reasons behind things like emerging adulthood. And so that's an important educational function. And a lot of times, religious communities, churches and such, have been operating on very little or inaccurate data. They're like flying blind. They don't really know what's going on. So I think it's a real contribution as social scientifically, just to say, look, here descriptively is what's actually happening out there, and here's why. That puts people in a position to respond to it intelligently and responsibly.
And the way that you speak about youth and emerging adults is so much more respectful and less disparaging than other speakers that I've heard. Mm. Where those lazy young adults, they just don't want to go to church because they don't care. But you've been speaking so respectfully of that age group. And, well, this is why they're, these are the factors.
Yeah, one of the things I've learned in this project, starting, back with 13-year-olds, is adults oftentimes misunderstand and mistreat young people and essentially blaming them for a lot of problems that really are adult problems. They're problems of the adult world, of the dominant society and institutions, and their own families. A lot of times adults sort of other young people and say, well, they're so bad or they're so different, we can't understand them, we can't fix them. The reality is young people, as I say in the book, are really great barometers or telltale indicators of what's going on in the larger society. So I think adults need to hear that. And adults need to be not let off the hook for their responsibility in forming the culture that teenagers are just buying into. Furthermore, as a sociologist, ultimately my job is not to judge people or condemn people. My job is to understand people, is to try to see let's assume people are reasonable. Maybe they're not, but let's start off assuming people are reasonable and understandable. Why do they do what they do? Well, lo and behold, there are real reasons. It's understandable. They're intelligible. May not like what they're doing, but you can understand why people, even reasonable people, would do things that young people do. And until people understand the real causes and not just condemn people, that's the condition of being able to respond to it well at all. So, I think it's really wrong to just kind of diss or condemn young adults or teenagers. They are mirrors that hold back up to the older adult world an image of what they themselves are, in my view. Moralistic therapeutic deism.
Tell me what that means.
Yeah, that's what I say in the book Soul Searching. That's the actual de facto functional religious faith of most teenagers in the United States. They're not Catholic or Methodist or Hindu or Jewish or Lutheran. They're moralistic therapeutic deists, and that basically means they believe in God. God created the world. God orders the world. God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other. That's what the Bible teaches and all religions teach. The point of life is to be happy and fulfilled and satisfied and to feel good about oneself. God doesn't need to be involved in one's life hardly at all. Unless you have trouble or a problem, then you can call on God to fix those problems and then send God away once they're fixed. And good people go to heaven. Those are the core beliefs of moralistic therapeutic deism. That's what most teenagers actually believe, whatever official religious tradition they're part of. And not just teenagers. Teenagers, I think, are learning this from people around them, including their parents, their churches, other adults, the broader society. This is, in some sense, I think, the real American religion. Not Christianity, Protestantism, Catholicism, it's moralistic therapeutic deism.
And so then in the end, if you're good and you believe there is a God, that's enough to go to heaven, and that's all that...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And being good is just defined as not being a jerk.
Not being horrible, yeah. Just be a nice person, be decent.
Which is entirely different than the doctrine of most Christian churches, that we're saved by grace through faith in Christ, and it's something that God has done for us.
Yeah, it's the exact opposite of Orthodox Christianity.
And that's what's being passed down, and that's the de facto, what they're... The worldview that they're operating on, no matter what they might say that they believe according to the church that they're in, that's what they're operating on.
That's what I've come to believe, yes. I've had some leaders in some denominations, more liberal denominations, say, well, we've succeeded. I mean, that's what we want, young people. That's what we, I mean, officially we used to believe in X, Y, and Z doctrine, but now we want people to just be good and nice and fair and tolerant.
Wow, well then they should join the YMCA. That's not
necessarily... Yeah, or at least the Unitarian.
In your book, you divide Protestantism between mainline mm-hmm. Protestantism, liberal, and conservative. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how those definitions...
Yeah, these are very standard definitions in sociology of religion. Conservative Protestant tends to be, you know, what are sometimes otherwise they're called evangelical or fundamentalist or charismatic or Pentecostal. So these are independent churches, Bible churches, community churches, and then more conservative churches like Presbyterian Church of America, Missouri Synod Lutheran is oftentimes grouped in the conservative Protestant. Mainline liberal Protestant are more sort of the bigger historic denominations that come over from a European heritage, the United Methodist Church, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, United Church of Christ, Episcopal Church. There's maybe six or seven big denominations that we call mainline Protestant that tend to group together. They're more liberal. They're more sort of middle of the road, liberal kind of outlook.
Are any of those three categories faring better as far as emerging young adults, retaining young adults? Or
yeah, absolutely. Young adults coming out of conservative Protestant backgrounds are much more likely to be still committed and serious about and practicing their faith. To be raised in a mainline Protestant denomination church is almost a guarantee that as an early emerging adult, you'll not at all be going to church or religiously involved.
Wow.
You actually have more chance of being religiously involved as an emerging adult if you were raised not religious than if you were raised a mainline Protestant.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Mainline Protestantism essentially inoculates its young people against being in the church when they're in their 20s.
What factors would contribute to that?
That's a whole other discussion, but I think that teenagers look at mainline Protestantism and they hear, well, the message here is basically be a good person. That's what's mostly being preached, be a good person, and I am a good person, and I already know that, so I don't need to keep going to church. Furthermore, conservative Protestants teach their young people, you know, you shouldn't have sex before you're married, you shouldn't be drinking, getting drunk, shouldn't be doing drugs. Those are less strong messages in mainline Protestant churches. So a lot of mainline Protestant kids are very happy to go off to college and party a ton, sleep around, and that they know that doesn't fit with church, and so they just, whether or not they'll ever get back to church someday is another question, but they're just not interested in it now. There's nothing really compelling or serious in it for them.
Do you think that the belief that what adults allow in moderation, their children will excuse in excess. Do you think that's true?
I think emerging adulthood has the ideology that when you're young, you should be wild and crazy. And especially if parents sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, we know you're having fun, just don't get a disease or don't get in an accident, be safe. Yeah, that sort of gives young people permission to run in excess with things that the parents sort of semi-condone.
So a lot of it still comes back to the basic family unit and to parental involvement.
Not all of it, but that's a powerful factor. Of course, it's possible for parents to be so strict that the kid is really rebellious. You know, the parents, A lot of it has to do with how good a relationship young people have with their parents, too. If young people have a lousy relationship with their parents and their parents are highly religious, then that gives them a disincentive to be religious. If young people have a really good, warm, close relationship with their parents and their parents are really religious, then that gives them a powerful incentive for them to be really religious. So it's not just what the parents are, but how good the relationship is with the teenager also feeds into this. It's all very complicated, but in some ways it's simple. You train up a kid to be something, and for the most part, that's roughly what they'll turn out to be.
Whether it's your intention or not.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of parents don't realize the influence they have. They think they're just living, but they're still forming their kids, even if they don't know it.
Thank you for sharing just matter-of-factly what the statistics show and what youth and young adults think without a judgment on it. You know, without, you know, a judgment call on it, and just so very like saying, this is what they think, this is, now you go and do something with this information. Instead of having an agenda that you're pushing, that you're saying, you know, you must do this, this, and this, you're saying, this is the situation, now.
Yeah, what about that? Yeah. Well, you're welcome, I'm happy to do that. That's my job as a sociologist, and I hope, you know, our research contributes to the faithfulness of the church and improving people's lives.
Final question before we go. What statistic or truth about emerging adults was the most interesting to you?
About emerging adults? Okay. Whew, let me think about that one. I mean, they're so interesting in so many ways. Of the emerging adults. I think the thing about emerging adults that most impressed me, because it's, again, it goes against the dominant story, is how much continuity there is between their teenage years and their 20s. We so much think, oh, so much change happens and they're changing in so many ways. And in certain ways they are, but really people are who they are, and there's continuity across the years in their lives, and they get on certain trajectories. And we've interviewed teenagers in the first wave of data collection, and you know, at the time you just guess, I bet I know where that kid is going in their life. 5 years later, that's exactly where they are. So it's not that people are absolutely predictable, but people are just not changing in crazy, random ways. People's lives are heading in certain directions that you can make sense of, that you can make pretty good guesses about where they're going, and there's a much more continuity across who people are than there is change.
Is there a certain age where that becomes
That's
static?
A great question. I mean, I don't know. We started at age 13, so.
So already by then?
Yeah, for some, yes. You can really guess. You get a sense for their families, how they talk, what their values and priorities are, and you just know where they're going. So a lot of this must get laid down in childhood. I mean, a lot of it is just since birth, and just who the family is, how they live, what they're committed to, that has powerful effects into their, you know, 20s.
Thank you so much. This has been so interesting, and I'll be praying that the church listens to the work that you've done and can figure out what to do.
Yeah, and if people are interested in this, not to be, you know, shamelessly self-promoting, but this has all been written up in books that,
yeah.
This and a lot more is in books that are laying this stuff out. So emerging adults who want to understand more about their lives and how they fit into the bigger picture, you know, I mean, they can read Souls in Transition and get a lot more.
I've been talking with Dr. Christian Smith, author of Souls in Transition and Soul Searching. Thank you.
You're welcome.